Ladies and gentlemen, I want to recommend a great book to you as I welcome you into another segment here. And David Ellison is our special guest. The book is called My Life with Death, and that's a name should be familiar to any fan of really, really hard rock and roll, as they call it, thrash metal, speed metal. But David Ellison, a bass player who hails from Minnesota back in the day, left as an 18-year-old kid, a small town in Minnesota, to make his way in the world. And boy, did he. Found some trouble, also a lot of triumph along the way, and put it all in a book that is a great encouragement to anybody who's a fan of music and is breathing at this point in time. David Ellison, I want to welcome you. And the first thing I want to do, and I said this to you off the air, and I'm going to say it to you again, thank you for putting that down, your life story, into these pages.
You're welcome. You're welcome. In fact, it's not something that I ever, I guess I thought about doing it one day. I didn't know that I'd be doing it at this point in my life. I figured these kind of books are something you do when you're old and crusty and sitting in the rocking chair. You look back over your life, tell the story. But I guess, you know, rock and roll is kind of like dog years. I guess I'm 49 years old right now, and you sort of multiply that by 7 maybe, and, you know, I'm about 150, so I don't know. It's the kind of thing where we pack a lot of living into a few short years. And as a result of that, there's a pretty good story there. There's a lot of, like you said, there's a lot of ups, a bunch of downs, and I think it all kind of leveled out somewhere in between. A
couple things I want to say to you. First of all, I've never met you, but I really like you. I can tell from reading your book, and also just from interacting with you for a second, you're just a guy, you know, and music was your career. But I got that from you. You know, I'm not a star here. We're not any different than anybody else. And you were a young kid, and you got sucked into something. And that can happen to anybody, can't it?
It can, absolutely. And look, I, from the age of 11, got the passion for rock and roll, played in rock and roll bands my whole life growing up. At age 18, made the move from Minnesota to California because I knew that's where the action was out in L.A. But at the same time, you know, I knew that along with that came some very potentially perilous behavior and some things that you could get drawn into. A lot of my story, even when I first took a drink of alcohol at age 15 out on the farm in Minnesota, you know, that rock and roll didn't do that to me. That was probably peer pressure as much as anything, or wanting to see what it was really like, because that's what everybody was talking about. Maybe that's it, or even then the peer pressure. That is always a common thing. I don't care how bold and much bravado a person claims to have. At some point, we all want to be accepted by somebody somewhere, and we will often do things that compromise our integrity, and we find ourselves in very compromised situations just seeking approval from people.
Yeah, and you know what? At the end of the day, see, I make my living in sports, right? And a lot of people find that in sports. They find that camaraderie. But a lot of people find it in gangs. You know, folks can say, well, how can somebody, like those 19 hijackers that did what they did on 9/11, hey, they were all in a brotherhood. And I totally get that. You know, and you're blind, and you're walking into something blind. You guys were self-destructing back then. But I look back on your story and I say, hey, there's God's hand. Hey, there's God's hand. Hey, there's God's hand. You didn't know it. You didn't know it at the time. But hey, God's providing for him. There's some providence. When you put your story down on paper, did you say to yourself, boy, God had me there. God had me there. I never really considered that. Boy, look at that. Did you do that at all?
You know, I have. And I've been in 12-step drug and alcohol recovery for now 24 years. So I've seen this stuff. You know, writing my book was not this, I had to write it to get something off my chest. I had to write it to somehow vindicate myself and clear the air. I didn't have to do it for any of those things, because one of the things that I've learned in recovery is that those things are meant to happen in a private setting, and they're meant to happen usually one-on-one, either with your mentor, sponsor, or then again going out and making amends to people. So that, you know, clearing the deck is not something that should happen in a public forum, which is why in my book I tried to be real careful about not throwing people under the bus.
Uh-huh.
My MO was, I have the right to tell my story, but I don't have the right to tell your story. And I think that plays back to, you know, your question you just asked, is I was pretty aware of where God always had me. You know, I was the one who moved away from God. He's not the one who left me. And I think that becomes a common thing, even for people of faith, to go, well, if there really is a God, then how could he have let this happen? You know, the age-old, well, why is there war and death and killing if there really is a God? Why would he let this happen? And to be honest with you, that was why I pulled that big fat book called The Bible down off my bookshelf one day, not too many years ago, quite honestly, within the last 10 years. I pulled it off the shelf and I started reading it. I was like, they say the answers are in there. I've never read that thing cover to cover, and I should probably read it. And it's funny because once I started reading it, I read it 4 years in a row cover to cover. And then I did a year of seminary training, which really brought the whole thread of the theology of the Bible really into my grasp. And it has definitely changed my view and changed my life for sure.
You know what's really interesting about your story? And I've got a young person in my community I'm going to give this to because he's a young man. In fact, he looks like you. And he's a friend of my daughter's. You'll appreciate this. He really does. He kind of has that Nordic look about him. And he's got the long hair. You know, he's the age of 14. He's like some of the kids I grew up with that we would have called the heavy metal crowd. I'm a couple years behind you. I'm 47. But back in those days when we were kids, and I grew up in a Catholic church, okay, there was no room for a David Ellison back then. And I would say in a lot of Protestant churches, there was no room for a David Ellison because David Ellison back then was told, the music you listen to is evil. You're wearing your hair too long. We have all these rules and these restrictions, and we're going to put you in a box. And here's the thing I love about your story. I think God is raising people up like you to let these kids know in this generation that I come in all shapes and sizes. Do not put me in a box. You can worship me through whatever you're going to worship me through. I'm a big God. I created it all. And I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I totally agree. And you're right. When I was growing up, and I wrote about it in my book, there's a ministry out of St. Paul, Minneapolis area, the Peters Brothers, and their whole mission was burning rock and roll records, saying this is the work of the devil and it's evil. And look, a lot of the people that created that music were certainly under, you know, I hate to say under Satan's spell because it sounds so mystical and so dramatic, but they definitely weren't marching to G.O.D., good orderly direction, you know, talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, you know. And I hear it today with mature ears listening to records on the radio. I go, oh, yeah, I remember when I was listening to that song. And at the time, I didn't understand it. I mean, I was just a babe in the woods and hearing songs about just that, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Can those things have an impression on a young person, even in a sort of in a way that's not even conscious? Yeah, I think probably so, for
yep.
sure.
Yep.
You know? So I get where they were coming from. I understand it. The method that's used and the approach to deliver God's word, he says we have to be crafty as the serpent, but gentle as a dove. So that, to me, is, and I used my own experience when I was getting sober 25 years ago. My sponsor said to me, he said, you know, it's important you always meet the new person where they're at. Don't expect them to be where you are. And I think going around on that sort of a witch-burning crusade and burning rock and roll records and telling people they're going south rather than north after death if they listen to this music, that is not meeting them where they're at. That's basically taking their idea and saying, you're wrong, we're right, and standing in a place of judgment as you're burning their albums. And to me, that's a repulsive approach rather than an inviting approach.
And I think that's well put. And that's why I want to put this book in this kid's hands and say, hey, look, at the end of the day, be who God made you to be. And it's okay. You know, wear the long hair. If you want to wear long hair, hey, man, and you want to rock out, rock out, but understand.
You know, one thing Christ always talked, especially to the Pharisees about, because the Pharisees were the ultimate, you know, they would put up laws and their hearts were hardened. The thing that he always did is he always examined people's hearts, in particular when he's talking about the food. He goes, look, it's not what you put into your body that makes you evil. It's what's inside of you that comes out of you that makes you evil. Christ was always saying, look, check your motives. If you're just wearing your hair long as a form of rebellion, well, look at your rebellion. And that's one thing that I realized as I was growing up. I didn't really have anybody to rebel against. I was a pretty good student, so my teachers liked me. I was raised in a Lutheran church, so I was fairly pleasant as a human being. My parents supported me in my music career, so I didn't have to rock out and rebel against them. when the rebellion was removed, you know, I really just played music just for the fun and the passion of playing it, you know, playing rock and roll for just the sound and the spirit that I got from it. So again, I think it always comes back to checking motives. I know a lot of people that I played with, their whole reason for playing the guitar was so that they could, you know, have sex, get drugs, and have acceptance and try to be important. And in my experience, that will always come back like a boomerang and cut you to shreds.
By the way, we visit today with David Ellison. My Life with Death is the book, and I want to encourage you to check it out. You will have trouble putting this book down, I promise you, if you pick it up, if you're interested in music. The stuff that you guys did, Dave Mustaine, I was doing a little bit of prep work outside of reading your book and watching a couple things on YouTube and saw that Behind the Music documentary. Now, Mustaine had a father that apparently was a pretty hard dude. There's a story in there where he grabs him, I think, by a pair of pliers by the ear and drags him down the street or some absurdly violent type deal toward your son. I mean, I can't imagine growing up in an environment like that. But he's a guy that kind of had that inside of him as a kid, and yet you didn't. So let me ask you, when you first found yourself in his world, was there enough anger there to channel for all of you in terms of when you were playing that music?
You know, for me, I didn't get together with Dave out of a resentment and a begrudging attitude. When I started playing his music, when I met him in 83 and he was writing his first post-Metallica songs, which would become the new Megadeth tunes, I just liked the progressive nature of them. They were kind of scary because they were so heavy at the time, and they just, the chord shapes and sort of the half-step movements within the chords that created this really just dark, ominous, heavy sound. And I liked it. It was cool. I mean, there's a little bit of dark in all of us. There's a little bit of light in all of us, you know, and I didn't get into psychoanalyzing it. I just knew it was like, wow, this is cool. I like it. It resonated well with me. And still does to this day. You know, we get on stage and we'll walk into a riff and just throw down, you know, eight times through that riff and the whole audience is grooving with us. It makes you realize music can control people. You can make them happy, like this number one song from Pharrell that's out there. I'm happy, you know. Or you can take a heavy Megadeth or a Black Sabbath riff and it, you know, makes your lip curl and makes you want to headbang. And that's the power of music. I come back to the same thing that, you know, God is the only one that can create. Satan can't create. So is this the work of the devil? Well, the devil made me do it. I don't know. I mean, he can certainly cause us, he can tempt us and lead us into temptation, which can lead to our fall for sure. But God is the creator. So he's the one that creates through us. And God also gave us a whole bunch of different emotions. Anger is also an emotion. Anger in and of itself is not a bad thing. Resentment certainly is a bad thing, you know, hanging on to an anger. Jesus was angry when he went into the temple and overturning the tables because people were making a mockery of the church, you know, turning it into a flea market. And Christ got angry at something that he knew his father would be upset about. So, and I'm not encouraging anger here in this interview, but I'm just saying that we don't always have to go, well, a good Christian wouldn't feel that way, so I better not feel that way. You know
what?
No,
that's exactly right. That's
exactly right. To feel something, you know, and go through the emotion.
Yep.
Because the emotion is probably a symptom of a symptom that needs to be resolved.
God is truth, right? And so if I have a day where I'm angry,
and sometimes, you know, and that's the point I think that in my experience with my drug and alcohol recovery is inventory is a big part of it. The reason why I never probably would have gotten sober through the church, it's probably why I grew up in the church, so why
That's
is it
right.
that one day I drank and went down that road? Why is that? I mean, and it's not to say that the church isn't enough. I think sometimes believers come in and go, oh, just love Jesus and it'll be fine. Well, you know, maybe ultimately, yeah. But again, meet people where they're at. And sometimes people need methodical processes and steps to walk through to get from the bridge of reason to the shore of faith.
That's really good. Let me tell you, God gives me a ministry. I grew up with depression problems, okay? And didn't really know what it was until into my early 30s and just struggled with it and didn't really tell anybody and just kind of had this darkness that I carried around with me even during my life as a believer. And it wasn't until I went to counseling and really sought to understand it. And now when I do my radio show, I tell people, hey, I struggle with this or have struggled with this. And what I find is when you lay things on the table, is that you attract people who come to you and say, hey, I'm hurting. And Will you talk to me? And just a word about truth for a second, because it's all in your story. I was sat across from a guy a couple years ago at a restaurant here in town. He says to me, "Hey, I got something I want to tell you." And I said, "Okay, tell me." He said, "Man, I don't know how to tell you this. I'm an alcoholic." I said, "Man, praise God." And he says, "Huh?" I said, "Hey, listen,
well, and the truth of
get
it
is, out there.
Is
get it out there.
We need to be broken in the right place.
That's right.
For us to crumble.
That's right.
That the Lord can help us.
I love brokenness. Yeah, brokenness is good.
The Lord doesn't help us in our strength.
That's right.
And not that he can't. It's just that we usually don't let him. You know, it's like the Lord, we usually only let God in when we're broken and we're crumbled and we're laying on the floor and we're all out of options and no other form of self-sufficiency works. That's when we turn to the Lord. And you know, kind of back to what we initially started this conversation with, which is being broken is a great starting place to get to know your Creator. That's what happened in the Garden of Eden back in Genesis 3. You know, everything was good. Man and woman were tempted. They went through with it. They fell. They broke away. Now, as a result of that, the rest of our lives here on this planet are about trying to get connected to God and then stay connected to Him. And that's the hardest part, because I think probably for most of us, you know, when I'm making some money and my romances are good and my finances are rocking and things are kind of rolling my way, I kind of start to move a little farther away from God. Mm-hmm. I'm like, "Hey, I got it going on."
Mm-hmm. You know,
the key word being I. But then sure enough, people disappoint us and things start to run amok. And so all of a sudden I stand there and all of a sudden I'm in self-pity and I'm indignant, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I never blame me first. I always blame you first.
That's right.
You know, you didn't do what I thought you should. And there comes the thing about, you know, a lot of times I see it on Facebook. People are like, "Never trust anyone." It's like, exactly. Nowhere in the Word of God did it ever say to trust people.
Somebody. That's exactly right.
Trust God, love people. Because people can't be trusted. Never meant to be. Because we're sinful, fallen, broken world that we live in. We can't trust each other. We're only human. We don't have enough resolve inside of us to be trusted. So the most we can do is love them. Love them when they're great. Love them when they're not so great. But love them all the same and put our wholehearted trust in God.
Let me say something about your book that I love. You do what you do with a sense of humor. You tell your story and you take yourself seriously, yet you don't. And we're talking with David Ellefson today, who is a guy you know. He's a world-famous bassist with Megadeth. The book is called My Life with Death. I love how you included your last report card. I love that. And the little caption where the teacher takes a shot at you. That's great stuff, man.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I didn't know if he was being serious, like, "Hey, good luck with your music career. Get out of here, kid. Go do what you're supposed to do." Or it seemed to me like it was kind of like, "Huh, yeah, right. Good luck with that music career," as I probably got a C or a D in this class. But, you know, as you speak to the report card, one of the things I talked about in my book is that, you know, I was on a good day, I was an A student. On any normal day, I was an easy B student, you know, without having to work too hard at it. But the moment I started pouring the drugs and booze into my body at age 15, that's immediately when I started to see my report cards go down into C's and D's, which was certainly unacceptable by my parents once you're kind of caught up into that drinking and drugging cycle. All of a sudden, things that were once important don't matter anymore, and academics, doing things that are esteemable, suddenly go away, and certainly my schoolwork was that. Of course, part of me, I was focused on music, and I knew that music was the thing I was going to go after, and that was not something I was going to probably excel at within the confines of a high school education. But, you know, they always told me, "Look, high school is the easiest as your life's going to be. It's only going to get harder from here." And boy, were they right. You know, because once you move out, now you're on your own. Now you got to provide for yourself, you know, based on your education and the efforts you put forward. You know, again, pay it forward. The harder you work earlier in your life, the less you have to work later. And those are the lessons that I did listen to and I paid attention to when I was in high school, for sure.
Hey, David, I love the musical parts of your book, and I love music myself. I play a little bit, and I can't imagine how hard it must have been for you to be an 18-year-old kid, to be out there in L.A., to be all alone. You wanted to go to Musicians Institute. You never quite got there because you met Dave Mustaine, and your journey was so interesting the way that all happened. Did you ever find yourself intimidated playing in front of people as a kid, playing in those clubs, saying, "Hey, can I measure up? Can I do this?" Was there ever any doubt in your mind that you could do it?
Well, you know, one thing that I liked about joining up with Dave is a very bold and brazen leader. He gets on stage, that guy shows no fear. It's almost like he's his best when he's on stage. To line up behind him as our fearless leader at the microphone as the lead singer, I'm always happy I'm on his team because, you know, you always feel like he's in control, whether it's 1,000 people or it's 100,000 people we're playing in front of. I always feel like he's in control of that audience. And he has a very magnetic personality to our fans. So that's a very cool thing. So I've been a guy who always enjoyed playing in bands. I don't mind taking the solo spotlight once in a while, but for the most part, I like to be a team player. I'm kind of part of the brotherhood mentality. And, you know, maybe being a bass player is also my personality. I chose that instrument because that's generally the role of that instrument within a musical ensemble. You're a foundation player. You're a foundation personality. For me, when I'm on stage with a group, I don't feel that way. There are times when I've been on stage solo by myself. Yeah, that can be a little daunting at times, but I think the more you do it, the more experience you get, the better you get at it.
You weren't afraid to experiment within the confines of that music. I read what other musicians say about you, and hearing some of that music, you weren't afraid to throw some things in that you learned along the way. Maybe things that up till that point didn't apply to that kind of music. Did you see yourself as somebody who was sort of breaking ground as a young kid?
I did, for sure. You know, I enjoyed, I think part of what you're referring to is, you know, I played a jazz band growing up just because I was looking for any opportunity to play the bass, you know, which then later in my life I started playing in churches because I'm home off the road with Megadeth and churches started reaching out to me saying, hey, if you're not busy Sunday, come and play bass for us. You know, so I was just always looking for opportunities to play, and I'm still like that. And I just have a passion for playing. I love being in the room with a bunch of musicians playing music, whether it's heavy metal, Christian music, praise music, I mean, pretty much whatever, I'll play it just because I like playing. And I applied those early jazz studies, and I was a sponge, just taking anything in to become a better player, a better musician, a better songwriter. So I would just absorb everything. And I think those things came out, especially when we started Megadeth. You know, here's this pretty progressive, fast, heavy music, and I'm glad I had those skills. I'm glad I was more than just a kind of four-on-the-floor rock and roll bass player. I'm glad I was real much more progressive and thoughtful kind of player. I think it really helped the Megadeth music a lot.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. And you stretched yourself, and you guys kind of stretched each other, didn't you? You guys kind of pushed each other there in Megadeth. Let me ask you this. When it came full circle, and you're clean, okay, so now fast forward the clock, and good past the part in the book in the early 2000s where you were in business and in the music side of the business side of the music industry, and you were staying at home and doing a lot of the things that you felt called to do, and I think it was great how you elaborated on that. But then you get the call, and you get the opportunity to go back and reunite with Dave Mustaine. Did you find, when you guys were clear, when you were sober, that you were better players? Did you find that when you were out there? Did it sound better to you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it definitely sounded better. I mean, just your motor skills are better when they're not inhibited by drugs and alcohol. You know, especially alcohol, it makes you sloppy. You can't drive a car on booze. Imagine trying to play your guitar on booze, you know. So, and plus a lot of same goes with other chemicals. And a lot of the other things, you know, the opiates and pills and all these things, you know, that are rampant in just in our society, period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, they cloud your judgment. You're not clear-headed. You can't make sharp, clear decisions. And a lot of making records and writing songs, it's a decision-making process. It's like, yeah, that sounds good. No, that doesn't. Let's write a better part here. Let's leave that alone. And then also, because music is spirit coming through a person into their, you know, through their instrument, when you hear something that really resonates with your soul, you know, you get the goosebumps, and you're just like, whoa, that is awesome. Or it makes you want to sing along to it, or it makes you want to drive down the road. You know, you're driving a little faster and headbanging in your car because it's rocking your world. And that's what music's supposed to do. It's an emotional activator, and it's hard to create emotional music when you're emotionally dead.
That's so profound. You really address this in your book, but I wonder, do you ever have this thought, what is it about drugs, alcohol, and the opiates, as you were talking about before, that seem to attract folks like yourself who are either artistic or musically bent or whatever, folks that act, drawn to the arts?
Well,
what do you think it is?
I think there's a couple sides to it. You know, there's left brain, right brain. And I think left brain is the creative, right brain is the sort of methodical, I have to balance my checkbook, I have to wake up at 8 p.m. or 8 a.m. rather, you know, I have to pay my bills. No, it's that side. And I think when you're in that, which is where most of us are kind of in our 9-to-5 life during the day, because we've got sort of things that we need to knock off of our checklist. When you go into the creative world, you're generally more over on the left brain. So you're not as attentive to, hey, I got to answer the phone, I got to pay my bills, I have to be responsible, because that part of the brain is not responsible for those tasks, which is why most creative people reside more over in the left brain. Well, that left brain, which is very pleasure-based, is always looking for sensations and sensual things and pleasures, and that's why drugs and booze and girls and sex and, you know, whatever, all these different things become people. It's hard to differentiate the true from the false and the real from the unreal when you're over in that mode. And the great lie of drugs and alcohol, of course, is try me, I'll make your life better. And initially, like, I haven't met a drug or a or anything yet that didn't kind of feel pretty good the first couple times I did it. But every time you continue to do it, it has a scientific physical reaction to your body that you become addicted to it, you become dependent to it, and suddenly it isn't about pleasure sensation. Now it's about doing it because it's habit. And that's the insidious nature of addiction, is kind of the try me, you'll like it sort of thing. And I think for musicians, when you're over in that pleasure sense thing over there, and it's probably even true with athletes, you know, as much as there's a motor skill thing, athletes are very creative in that moment. They're very, out on the ball court for a basketball player, for instance, there's, you know, your moment in strategies, and even for, you know, finance people who are, you know, there's a lot of creativity involved in achieving high excelling positions in the world. It isn't just a methodical kind of, you know, right brain thing. There's very much a left brain thing involved, and when you're over there, you are susceptible to laying yourself open to some of those temptations and dangers out there.
David Ellefson, again, I want to thank you for joining us. I want to thank you for your witness and just for putting it on paper. On the way out, musically speaking, stop and think to yourself, hey, what's next for me?
I do, all the time. Sometimes you're in the process, you're on a tour, you're making a record, and kind of know what the next step is. City, the next leg of the tour, this is what we're doing for the rest of this year, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, then there are these moments. In fact, I just went through one. This been off the road here for the last 3 months for the most part, and home with my family and plugging in with that and sort of debriefing off the road. And it's been a cool season. Sometimes when there's not a lot of activity and a lot of stuff on my plate is when I start to get nervous. I've learned over the years that, you know, the Lord provides. You know, we ask this day our daily bread, and God knows our needs, and, you know, he gives us what we need. At the same time, you know, I'm human, and I get into fear sometimes. Oh my gosh, is this it? What's next? I guess one of the good things about being clean all these years from the drugs and booze and, you know, having a conscious contact and connection with my creator is that God doles out our life a day at a time. And sometimes it's an hour at a time and even a minute at a time. So I think it's important to be in the now, because that's where God is.
Mm. I was talking with somebody about that this morning. And that's a discipline, isn't it? Learning to live, no matter who we are, learning to live in that moment is very difficult.
Live for the moment. And I mean, look, even Luke 9:23 says it, you know, and someone asks Jesus, what do I got to do to basically be a Christ follower? And he says, well, first, deny yourself. Second, take up your cross and follow me daily. He even says it, you know, Christianity, it's a one day at a time program. Runs concurrently with how I got sober. One, just you can do for a day what you can't do for a lifetime. You do it enough days in a row, that becomes your lifetime.
Hey, David, on the way out, I'll let you have the final word here. Anything that you want to add, anything we haven't touched on, please go ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, thanks for the call. I appreciate it, and I'm glad to have our discussion. And yeah, my book, My Life with Death, it's, you know, again, it's my life up till this point. And it's just my life through my eyes. It's my experience, my testimony, like you said. And hopefully it's something that'll be inspiring to some. And hey, if I'm out of line on something or incorrect on something theologically, I'm certainly open for discussion. And to be able to be sort of rebuked and stand corrected is also part of our growing in our spiritual walk. So I'm just a work in progress.
I really, really appreciate you taking some time for us. And again, thanks for putting it down in this book. And I know that God's going to use it, and you're going to have some wonderful rewards from doing this. And hey, continue to live in freedom, man. It's a great thing.
That's exactly what it is. Look, to do all this stuff, which sounds like a lot of work and sort of boring doldrum, the truth of it is the disciplines give you the freedom. The freedoms don't sometimes you think, oh, I just want to be free. Well, that all that does is makes you a drifter. So sometimes it's the disciplines that, well, not sometimes, always, that it's the disciplines that give you the rewards.
David Ellison, thanks again, man.
You're welcome. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you, David.